Ignition number 11211, reel 2.
Ronald Malabar, Reel 2. We were discussing the terrain in Normandy in which you were fighting, Mr. Malabar. Is there anything further you'd like to say on that subject?
I would just like to mention one occasion when we were dug in around one of these little Norman fields. We had our trenches around the outside of the field. We were being shelled, and our own guns behind us were firing at the German batteries. And a British spotter plane went up, and it was watching the fall of the shot on the German positions when it came under fire from a German anti-aircraft battery. And the pilot immediately dived down into our field and flew round and round just above head height while the anti-aircraft shells burst among us. And we wanted nothing more than for this man to go away and climb up a bit higher and get himself killed rather than get us killed.
Were there many instances of this kind of thing where you had shell fire aimed at you either from Germans or British and actually fell in your positions?
Oh yes, we weren't only hit by German shells, we were sometimes hit by our own, where they were falling short. In fact, there was an incident later in Holland which I can perhaps tell you about sometime, but that was much later on, where we felt that really badly.
At Hotto, how far were the Germans away from you?
Well, I they were never within my view. I was aware of their presence because shots would come over and shells would come over, of course, but perhaps about half a mile, quarter of a mile to half a mile, I suppose, at that time. But around about this time, the Germans went on the run. And we did a lot of travelling just trying to catch up with them.
What were the scenes that you were coming across as you were travelling through the countryside chasing Germans?
Burned out farmhouses, dead animals, bags of graves, little mounds of earth with a cross at the top, a wooden cross, or a rifle with a helmet stuck on top of it. And the helmet always seemed to have a little round hole in it, which we didn't like very much. In fact, at this time, the pioneer section of the battalion spent its time making little wooden crosses, and it used to be quite worrying to see them working away at battalion headquarters, making these little crosses for when we pushed somebody under the ground. We used to, if anybody got killed, we just had to wrap them in a blanket and bury them, and that was that. They had to be fished out later by the graves, proper graves people.
Did you come into contact with any of the French population?
Not very often, because we were mostly on the move and out in the country. But the first Frenchman I saw was before I joined the Durham Light Infantry. He was a typical Frenchman in the blue jacket and trousers and the little black beret, and he came out out of a house and with a broad Cockney accent, he offered me a cup of coffee and a cognac, and he said he used to live in London and he'd had this bottle of cognac buried ever since the Germans had overrun France, and he'd saved it for this occasion when the Tommies arrived. And he had a broad Cockney accent. He said he used to live near Knightsbridge Barracks, he called it. And after that I had very little to do. I used to see French people about. A lot of them used to come out and put armbands on their arm with FFI on them for French Forces of the Interior, but we didn't have much respect for them because we were sure they would take them off again as soon as we got pushed back.
Do you recall any actual actions that you and your mortar platoon were in the time that you were advancing through Normandy?
No, nothing in particular. We just seemed to fire off a few rounds when we were told to at that time. And this was only a brief period when I was with the mortar platoon, because after that I was being moved about, you know, attached to this company and that company and sometimes at battalion headquarters.
So you weren't with the mortar platoon very long?
Not for very long, no.
And then, as you say, you moved in to various places within the battalion, presumably. Mm-hmm.
Yes, we sort of took turns being attached to a rifle company or somewhere else. Most of the time we were either with a rifle company or at battalion headquarters operating a radio or a switchboard or something.
With a rifle company, what particular duties and responsibilities did you have?
Well, we would normally have to keep with the company commander or the second in command and really relay orders to him that were coming from battalion headquarters or to send back to battalion headquarters that we were in trouble or we needed help or we needed something. Or
do you recall any times when you were in trouble and you had to put a message back to battalion headquarters?
Well, it was mostly asking either for artillery fire in front of us or asking our own guns to lift their fire because it was dropping among us. Most of the time it was just a case of rushing about and trying to follow the company commander about and follow what he was doing and try to anticipate where he was going and what he wanted next.
Did you feel at all conspicuous with the company commander with his set on your back?
Yes. I think the signaller was the most unfortunate person because by that time, all the officers had taken off their badges of rank and they carried rifles so that nobody looked any different to anybody else except the poor signaller who had this great big radio on his back, and he was the sniper's target, in fact. They would have liked to shoot the officers as well, but they had no means of picking them out. Sergeants even and NCOs used to take their stripes off their arms and put them low, as low down on their sleeve as possible if they wore them at all. But the signaller not only had problems taking cover with his radio on his back, he was very obvious to the enemy.
Were there considerable losses amongst the signalling section?
Yes, there were quite a lot. There was one position we were in where we had to do what we called a standing patrol, which was just to stay in one position and listen and report back any movements. And night after night, we would go to relieve them and we would find the radio in the canal and the signaller gone or the signaller dead.
Was this a situation where you're out in between the two opposing?
Yes, out in front of the forward positions, really.
And did you go with a patrol or with other people, or were you taken out?
You were just taken out and left in that particular kind of job.
And would that be on your own?
Yes.
And did you personally have any of those to do?
No, I never got round to that. That was something that I missed.
How did you feel yourself when you first came under enemy fire?
Well, it wasn't going to happen to me until I was wounded for the first time. It wasn't happening to me. There were people around me and they were falling down dead or they were lying about badly wounded. But it wasn't me. It was like being at the pictures. And until you're actually wounded yourself, you don't think, at least I didn't. I was just making the best of it. When I was eventually wounded, I realised just how mortal I was, and I decided that the war would go on forever until I was killed, really.
You didn't have any anticipation as to how the war was going and would end?
No, just life consisted of the battalion. And in fact, when you're away from the battalion, you want to be back. You feel lost away from it, even though you know you're going back perhaps to be killed. I was in hospital in this country, and I was just longing to get back to the real world, which was the battalion. Yeah, it sort of dominated your life. There was nothing else.
Was that a common feeling amongst your comrades?
Yes, surprisingly enough. They couldn't wait to get back, because you had such a bond with the fellows that you worked with. You know, you knew that you'd have to rely on them, perhaps many a time, to save your life, and you would do the same for them. And you loved each other, and you just wanted to be with them.
Did you ever see any instances of men who cracked under fire?
I never actually saw any. There was one occasion when two members of the battalion were supposed to have run away and been killed by a stray shell. But I never knew who they were, and I never actually saw anybody crack up. Some people certainly were terrified, but it didn't make any difference. They didn't run away or anything.
What effect had fatigue and stress upon your own nerves at all? Had it any effect?
The main thing I used to feel was I used to hallucinate if I was really worn out, you know. I mean, you could be going at it for days on end, and I would see people that weren't really there. And that was the main effect it had on me. It didn't make me terrified and want to get out of it or run away, but that was one effect it did have. I could see people just standing about or walking towards me, you know.
And were these people that you'd known in the past?
No, just figures, really.
Did you have any strong religious beliefs which helped you in this situation?
No, I didn't really.
So your strength really lay in your comrades in the battalion?
That's it, yes. You were so close to them, as I say, you know. You lived with them all the time, and you went through some terrible times with them, and you just wanted to be with them.
And there would be great pride at being a member of the battalion, is that
the case? Oh, yes, yes. You thought that there was nobody else like you and your battalion. You were, certainly in my case, I was very proud of what I was doing, and very proud of being in this Durham Light Infantry and in the divisions that I was in.
And this was true of the whole battalion setup?
Yes.
Yeah. Did you see any cases of shell shock?
I never came across any personally, no. No. There was talk of battle fatigue, which was the modern term for shell shock, but I never personally had any dealings with anybody who suffered from it. Mind you, there were times when we would scrabble on the earth and try to become part of the earth, trying to get as far as possible out of the line of fire, but I never saw anybody that had a really sort of lasting effect from it. That's not to say it didn't happen, but I personally didn't come across it.
Were there moments when you were under such severe shell fire that you thought, well, the next one's going to land on me?
Oh, yes. Yes. And I suppose we really were terrified because the earth would be erupting around you and people would be being killed and earth would be being thrown over you. And it really was a terrible thing, but you got over it. And in fact, we sometimes used to discuss which we hated the most. Was it the 88mm gun that the enemy used? Was it his mortars, which dropped bombs out of the sky onto you? Or was it the machine gun? And it was the machine gun that worried me, especially the submachine gun, because when I heard that rattling away, I knew that they were in among us, whereas the shells seemed more impersonal. You know, if it was going to hit you, it was going to. But the man with the submachine gun was probably just along the street or just in the next house or just behind the next tree. And that was the one I didn't like. And as it happened, the first time I was wounded, that was what I was wounded by.
The German mortar was the Minenwerfer.
Well, they had both kinds. They had the Minenwerfer, which was the imitation smoke projector, which as you probably know, they weren't allowed to have mortars prior to the war, under the terms of the disarmament treaty. So they had what they call smoke troops, and the people who operated these Minenwerfers were always called smoke troops, and there were smoke units. But they didn't fire smoke, they fired bombs. And the Morning Mini was the title we gave to them because they made such a noise as they were coming over. Excuse me. But they also used ordinary mortars of the kind that we used, like a vertical pipe that just fired bombs up in the air.
And the 88s, had they a distinctive sound?
Yes, they had a very sharp crack. And the shell arrived practically before you heard anything else. It was a very high-velocity gun. In fact, it was an anti-aircraft gun, really. But it was adapted for ground use when they found that it was such a useful weapon on the ground. It was very useful against tanks or infantry, anybody.
The support elements which would be with you in action, what form did they take?
Well, I suppose you mean people like engineers and signalers and whatnot. We're always aware of engineers and people like that behind us, you know, but we sort of were at the sharp end all the time. There was nobody between us and the enemy, and anybody else was behind us. we used to have a small detachment from the Royal Corps of Signals at battalion headquarters, and they were in communication with brigade and further back.
What about the air support? Did you have air support in any particular instance?
Certainly in Normandy we did. We could call up the Typhoons, which were the airplanes that that we came across mostly, and they would clear roads in front of us to great effect. They used to also shoot us up as well.
They made mistakes?
Yes.
Were you ever in a situation where you were calling this for this kind of support?
Never personally, no. It used to be called up by somebody or other at the time, but I never actually called it up. I was at the receiving end of it once when they fired along our column, and I was in a Bren gun carrier, and I had to jump over the side and yank the plug out as I went. But it didn't do much harm on that occasion, but it did at times cause quite a lot of casualties. And what surprised me was that because we had air superiority, we used to carry fluorescent panels on the tops of all our vehicles, bright coloured panels, so that they knew it was us, but it didn't stop them.
Artillery support, was that of any help to you?
That was usually very good. The artillery were, I think, about the most efficient branch of the army at that time. And they used to fire what they called fire tasks in front of us. Used to be behind us and fire over our heads, you know. They were pretty efficient at clearing the way for us.
You would have an anti-tank element with you?
Yes, there was an anti-tank platoon which was part of company headquarters, and they had six-pounder anti-tank guns by that time. They had had smaller things which were very ineffective earlier, but by this stage in the war, the six-pounder anti-tank gun was pretty effective. And particularly if we were static, they could set themselves up under cover and break up any tank attacks that were coming in.
You said that you were at Falaise. Do you have memories of that particular time?
Yes, I remember seeing about 500 German bodies piled in a heap and set on fire as they were retreating. That was a horrible sight. I remember the rifle brigade who were part of the 7th Armour Division at that time. This was before we were transferred into 7th Armour Division. There was a half-track of theirs sitting on the road, smouldering, with lines of soldiers sitting along each side, all dead and burning away.
So there was a great deal of
terrible death. Because German columns were getting jammed, you know, there were real traffic jams, and the RAF were just coming over and shooting them up. And the Germans had a lot of horse-drawn transport as well, and they couldn't move very quickly. Horses were all killed. There were dead horses all over the place, and dead men, of course.
After Falaise, where did you go thereafter?
We struck up north, and this was the beginning of Operation Market Garden, which was when the airborne troops were to seize the bridges, and 30 Corps, of which we were a part, were to drive up through Belgium and Holland and cross the Rhine, was the idea, into Germany. And of course, as you know, it didn't work. But at the very beginning of it, we crossed the Albert Canal behind the Irish Guards, who had established a bridgehead, and we passed through them and out into the open country beyond the Albert Canal. This is the three battalions of the Durham Light Infantry that were in 151 Brigade, the 6th, 8th and 9th. After we got over there, we arrived in a town called Geel, and I remember a little incident there. Geel took quite a bit of fighting to take it, and there was a group of us in a street, and we found ourselves in a big cellar underneath a house, and it was very dark. But somebody found that one wall of the cellar was lined with shelves on which were jars of preserved fruit. Well, we'd had nothing decent to eat for weeks, so we opened the fruit and were eating this pears and plums and things, when somebody shone a light, and we saw that the other three walls of this big cellar were lined with children, old men, women, all sitting with their backs to the wall and their legs stretched out in front of them, and absolute terror in their eyes, because they didn't know who we were. We could have been the SS as far as they were concerned. But being British soldiers, we were so embarrassed when we saw this that we quietly walked out of the cellar and got on with the war.
Argyll was a particularly savage action. What are your memories of that, of the fighting?
My memories there are really of shelling and firing. And I remember seeing a German killed and dropping his three stick grenades that he had, these stadium ashes as we call them, and it was run over by, I can't remember what sort of vehicle, some sort of a vehicle, and it's squashed all the wooden handles, but the things didn't go off, and they were still there when I left. I wasn't going to be bothered with them. But the fun started for me after we got through Geel and out into the open country, and we lost contact with A Company, which was one of our rifle companies, and at the time I was at battalion headquarters. And we signallers were very concerned about this because we would hear the radio of A Company getting fainter and fainter. Nobody was sure where A Company was, and we knew the battery was running out. So four of us decided we would volunteer to go and try and find A Company and take them a battery for the radio and reopen communications. So this was accepted that we would do this. And then we thought we'd make an even better job of it. We would take reels of cable, and we would take telephones, and we would establish a line to them. Of course, we had to find them first and then lay the line back to battalion headquarters. So we set off at 3:15 in the morning, September, and it was bitterly cold. We didn't have our overcoats with us because they were left behind miles further back, so we had our anti-gas capes on, these long waterproof sort of oilskin coat things, and we were festooned with reels of cable and telephones and a battery and our own personal equipment, rifles and things. We set off in pitch dark up the road. We turned left along this country road and came into the light of a house which was burning on the opposite side of the road to us, and it was like daylight there. And immediately there was a German shouted and fired his submachine gun, and I felt just as if I'd been hit on the shoulder with a hammer, you know, just like being hit with a big sledgehammer. And I was knocked into the ditch. The other three, the fellows who were with me, were in the ditch as quickly as I was. And I felt at my coat and found, sure enough, there was a hole in the back and there was a hole in the front, so something must have gone through me. And I said to the nearest fellow to me, Geordie Metcalf, I said, Geordie, I've been hit. He said, I'll get the bastard. And he grabbed his rifle and tried to get out of the ditch. But I pulled him back and I said, Geordie, if you stick your head up there, you're going to lose it. And we're never going to get the job done. We'll have to crawl away along this ditch. So I took out of my pouches the two German grenades that I always carried about with me and threw them away over into the field, because I thought, if I'm going to get captured, I'm not going to have German equipment on me. And we started to crawl along this ditch. Well, pitch dark, in a ditch, dragging equipment with you, and the worst part, kneeling on the front of your gas cape coat thing. Every time we tried to move forward, we fell on our faces. But we managed to get about a couple of hundred yards up this ditch. Incidentally, Belgian ditches are wonderful for infantrymen. They're deep and wide and they're kept clear. And it's not like Normandy where there aren't any ditches at all to speak of. We were going along this ditch when a figure popped up, which fortunately we recognised as the major commanding the missing A Company. And he led us out of the ditch and into the farmyard where he had his company headquarters. And he told us about this German tank that was away up the road, just standing there doing nothing. But it had him worried and it had everybody else worried. And he took us into a barn where he had company headquarters. And I was had field dressings put on my shoulder and an arm in a sling. And in this barn there were two wounded Germans, three tank men of ours who'd lost their tank, and they were giving one of the Germans a morphine injection. And there was a rifleman guarding the two Germans who really weren't capable of doing anything or running away. But he was engaged in an argument with the least seriously wounded one about 12 members of the Royal Norfolk Regiment who had allegedly been captured by the Germans and shot. And this German said, "That is not correct." And this rifleman of ours thought that he was calling him a liar. So I had to explain to him that what he meant was, such conduct is not correct, shooting members of the Royal Norfolk Regiment when they're prisoners.
Had you heard this story? Had you heard of
this? This was a story. There were regular stories like this going around in Normandy and then further on. But this was one in particular that always seemed to stick, that captured 12 members of the Royal Norfolk Regiment and they'd shot them. But this fellow didn't like being called a liar, as he thought, but the man wasn't calling him a liar. He was naturally, he wouldn't want anybody to think that he agreed with it, and he was saying that it's not correct to do that sort of thing, and I was able to quieten them all down. But anyway, but by the time daylight came, we decided it was time I was moved out of it, because I was no use to anybody. And A Company, like everybody else, had one of these German Jeeps, as we called them, the Volkswagen forerunners of the Beatles, the square slab-sided things. So they put me in this with a rifleman, out of the farm gate, turned left, and we saw the tank up the road to our right. But the driver put his foot down, and away we went. And we met a carrier from the 8th Battalion. They were on their way to Brigade Headquarters, so I thought, well, I'll go with them. So I did, and I was evacuated to Brussels, which was further back. We'd been through Brussels, so I arrived back in Brussels.
Did you receive any treatment on the way back to Brussels? Were there some of the other medical centre that you went through?
There was a field dressing station where they took off the dressings that had been put on me by the stretcher bearer at the Forward Company, and patched it up and put another sling on. And then I was put in an ambulance and sent off, as I say, to Brussels. And I was taken into the general hospital there, which was empty. They'd cleared all the beds because they were waiting for all the casualties that were about to come in from Operation Market Garden. And this was at the very beginning of that particular operation. And there were five of us on stretchers in the corridor outside the wards. And then all of a sudden somebody came and told us all to get up and put us in an ambulance again and took us to the airfield. And we were put in one of the Dakotas that was coming back from dropping the parachutists. And we arrived back in England, which was great for me.
And whereabouts in England were you taken to?
We landed at an airfield whose name I've forgotten. It was rather dark. And we were put in an ambulance and taken off. And I arrived in Walsall, in the general hospital at Walsall. And it was interesting, on the way there, I could see out of the window of the ambulance in the dim light, and I couldn't understand what was wrong with the countryside. But before we got to Walsall, I realised there were no little humps with a rifle stuck up and a tin helmet on the top. I'd got so used to everywhere I went to seeing these little pathetic little humps of earth with a rifle or a cross on it, that the countryside didn't look right without it.
What was your reception like in the hospital?
Oh, well, it was full, really, of wounded soldiers and sick soldiers and things. And I was operated on in the theatre, of course, and patched up. But there's always somebody more badly hurt than you are, so you don't get the chance to feel sorry for yourself. And then, of course, this thing comes back again of wanting to get back to the battalion.
How long were you in the hospital?
I was there for about... just a month, I think. It's 3 weeks or a month, something like that. And I was sent home on leave.
How many days leave did they give you?
I was on leave for a fortnight. I met my wife, so it wasn't all bad. And then I was sent off.
Was your family still living in Newcastle?
Yes. Yes, I came home there.
And did they know that you were in hospital at Walsall?
They found out eventually. But the first message that they got was that I was missing, presumed killed, because, as I told you, I'd got into a carrier belonging to the 8th Battalion. The 9th Battalion didn't know where I was. But eventually they got another message saying I'd been wounded. And then eventually they were told that I was in Walsall, and they were able to actually come and see me once there. Of course, there wasn't much travelling about the country during the war, but they did come and see me once.
What was your parents' reaction to your wound?
Oh, my father thought it was great. And I don't remember my mother being terribly concerned. But my father was always thrilled to bits with anything like that because, as I say, he'd been in the army in the First World War, and this was something for him to boast about. His son had been in action and had been wounded now. In fact, at a later stage, I remember him, he took me into a pub right at the end of the war, and he told everybody that his son had been wounded twice and had three battalions wiped out in the course of his service. Which was elaborated a bit.
So on your 2 weeks leave, you would obviously be meeting people that you knew before your army service. What was their reaction to you?
Well, it was just the thing that happened, really, I suppose. I had one annoying incident. I think this was really the second time I was wounded. I was on leave again, and I was walking up the main street in Newcastle with festooned with flags on my sleeve and two wound stripes, and a young military policeman stopped me and asked me for my pass. And I never liked military policemen.
So you were quite annoyed at that?
Yes, yes. I didn't do anything about it, but I wasn't very pleased to think of what my friends were doing, and somebody's here asking me if I've got a pass to be here.
Did you feel when you were on leave the first time, particularly, and you saw presumably men of military age who possibly were in some other occupation and weren't in the forces, did you feel any anger or any had you any particular feelings towards this?
No, I don't think I felt that very much. In fact, my best friend worked in a factory and was in a reserved occupation, and he never went in the armed forces during the war.